Well, our traveller's tale today takes us to Japan and to Tokyo, where, as my next guest suggests, change just is a tradition. I was captivated by the imagery in this book. It really effectively chronicles the evolution of Tokyo, one of the world's great cities and the traditional seat of Japanese government, commerce and culture. It's also a city that knows tragedy. Throughout its history, it's been destroyed by fire, flood, disease, war and earthquakes. But it's always rebuilt and re-emerged, reshaped by its past, no doubt, but always with a primary eye to the future. Of course, in a way, it's an examination, a story like this, of the psyche of its inhabitants. Just what is it that makes them so resilient and pushes them to adapt and flourish? Stephen Mansfield's an author and freelance photojournalist who's lived in Chiba Prefecture, which adjoins Tokyo, for the last 17 years. He's widely writes for various magazines and newspapers around the world. His latest book is Tokyo, a biography. Stephen, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much. Yes, and thanks for that very impressive introduction.
Well, I want you to build on it now, you see. And I'm going to break the rules a bit, if you don't mind, and go to the towards the end of your book, where you say that Tokyo is infatuated with modernity. And there's this great line: if Tokyo's unable to peer at its history in the mirror, it's because its surface is so clouded with building dust. Now, look, I don't think that's what many Australians would imagine.
Well, perhaps not literally building dust. I think it's an interesting metaphor. But I think I also say in that last section, I talk about Tokyoites or Japanese in general, perhaps, having what I say is an abiding faith in the totemic power of modernity. I think there is this, unlike Europe, there is this sort of sense that you can actually improve on the past. I don't think a European would say, for example, that you could build something better than Notre Dame or Blenheim Palace. But I think in Tokyo, you see that going on all the time.
And of course, you do in China too. It's interesting. Much, much less devotion for the past than there is in the West.
I think so. There's a fairly weak preservation ethic, I think, in Japan in general. I see that happening a little bit in Europe. I mean, I come from Britain, my last trip to London, I saw that. I mentioned in the book that when I was a child, or even perhaps even three decades ago, the tallest buildings in London were church spires. But a lot of those buildings are now occluded by skyscrapers. So we see the same process happening in other parts of the world. But I think in Tokyo, in the case of Tokyo and Japanese cities in general, it's much more accelerated and the scale is completely different.
And you do wonder out loud, very interestingly, whether it is related to Buddhism with its underlying sort of ambivalence about attachment to material things.
Absolutely. I think I mentioned the sort of Taoist theories and Buddhist theories about the impermanence of life, and that also applies to material things like buildings and so on. I think you see this kind of made radical surgery going on in Tokyo all the time. It's like a perpetual facelift.
Oh, very clever. Now, let's go back a bit then, because you've written that by 1720, the population of Edo, or ancient Tokyo, was more than 1.3 million, and it made it bigger than London and Beijing. I had no idea about that. And you suggest it was the lower orders, as it were, who dictated the character of the city. How did they shape the city's character?
Well, I think, as you said, it was the largest city in the world, but nobody knew that, of course. People in London or Paris or wherever, they had no idea of the scale of Tokyo. I think that the city was divided, really, into the so-called Yamanote, the upper city, the high city, and the Shitamachi, which was the low city. And the low city was crowded with people. It was very populous, and the population increased exponentially each year, and people came into Edo, which was the de facto capital. I mean, Kyoto was the actual capital, but Edo became the de facto capital. So it was where the work was, and that's what really drew people in. But later, as the masses had more wealth and more time and more thirst for entertainment and culture, that sort of side of Edo, old Tokyo, developed, and you had this efflorescence of popular culture.
Yes, and they were extremely proud of it, weren't they? Which all pertains to what comes and how they cope when there's such terrible disasters. So it really fostered this sense of belonging there, didn't it?
Yes, I think belonging, but at the same time a certain degree of non-attachment, which made it easier to rebuild and to sort of face the next transformation in a way that most of us wouldn't be able to do. Yeah.
Well, indeed, these natural disasters, my goodness, you know, it's positively replete with it. Fire, flood, cholera, earthquakes, great swathes of razed to the ground, hundreds of thousands killed. Yet each catastrophe seems to be the genesis of a stronger, sort of reimagined Tokyo.
It is a reimagined one. The real, the sort of the material, physical Tokyo, of course, vanishes, and that comes back to the way that Tokyoites and Japanese in general, I think about history, which is very different to, say, Europeans and probably Australians as well, where we like to actually see history in front of our eyes. I think history tends to be preserved in a different way, let's say, in Tokyo. It's preserved in songs, film, urban legends, and so on. And people seem to be satisfied with that. There are a great many streets in Tokyo, for example, called Fujimizaka, which means Mount Fuji viewing streets, which were delightful places where you could stand and get views of Mount Fuji. But none of those exist now. But the name exists, and that seems to be enough for most people.
Yes, you quote Charles Beard, an American political scientist and town planning specialist, after seeing the devastation of the 1923 fire, that's just one of them, where 400,000 buildings were destroyed and about 63% of Tokyo's population made homeless. And he suggests that not since the fire which destroyed three-quarters of London in 1666 had so large a portion of a great city being wiped out. But, I mean, none of us know about it.
That's right. Well, there are a lot of things that happened. I mean, obviously, there were news, media, newspapers, internet, things like that didn't exist. But you would have thought that disasters of that magnitude would have reverberated in other parts of the world. But a lot seems to have passed by popular historians' commentary. I mean, I think that the air raids on Tokyo, I mean, everybody knows about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the air raids on Tokyo, which killed somewhere between 80,000 and 100,000 civilians, are virtually unknown outside Japan, but these were devastating losses.
Indiscriminate. That's a very strong part of your book. My guest
is
Stephen Mansfield, who about the evolution of Tokyo. I must say, the 334 bombers dropped a total of 1,700 tonnes of incendiaries on the city in one night, March the 9th, 1945, and between 80 and 100,000 civilians perished that night, which is the single most destructive bombing mission in military history. So it is a devastating sort of toll, but again, they picked themselves up. And do they talk about it a lot?
No, very little, in fact. In fact, the city, in general, is not really celebrated that much. I mean, it's only a few years ago that there could have been joyful celebrations about the 400th anniversary of the city, but I didn't see any of those things happening. So it seems that people are fixated on the present and future.
Do you reflect, I wonder, Stephen, whether this is a really incredibly important difference to note between a sort of Western take on the world and what you might call an Eastern take on the world, you know, given that we're in the century we're in?
I think to some extent, you mentioned in your introduction about change, there's a sort of well-known comment that the translator, writer Edward Seidensteker made, that the argument between tradition and change, which we often engage in Western countries, is irrelevant in Japan because change itself is a tradition. I think that still holds today, yeah.
Look, you did host the Summer Olympics in 1964, which I remember. Was that another major turning point for the city?
I think it was. It was, Japan's sort of coming out party, really. It was a chance for it to rejoin the international community after the stigmas that attached the country after the Second World War. Remember, it was only 19 years after the end of the World War. Tokyo had been slated, I think, to actually hold the Games in 1942 or 43, but of course that was cancelled. So it was Japan's chance to sort of show the world. It was a showcase event, and it put everything into it to make sure that it was successful. I do mention in the book, of course, that there is always a downside to all the tributary comments that I make, and one of them was, of course, the older aspects, more charming aspects of the city, like the canals. There was a wonderful network of canals that were active at that time. They were filled in with building rubble. Overhead flyovers were built over bridges. There was a sort of vulgarizing of the city, the haste to make it look like a sort of modern, futuristic, assertive, ambitious city.
And look, finally, rather odd note to end on, but apparently almost everyone agrees on the imminence of catastrophe in the form of a long overdue mega quake. How do you think Tokyo would handle a disaster on that scale? I mean, you must be confident it would recover again, are you?
Well, it will recover again for sure, but quite what impact is a mega earthquake would have is difficult to imagine. The government seems to brush it off. It seems to be very confident that all its buildings are earthquake-proof. But in fact, there are hundreds of thousands of buildings which are made of timber-framed buildings covered in plywood and mortar. And if there were to be an earthquake, these would dissolve like biscuit. So it depends where you live, I think. And that brings you back to the old disparities between the wealth disparities in the city, which Japan, I think, in general likes to think of itself as an egalitarian country, but there are huge disparities. If you're living in the west, there's more salubrious areas where building materials are better, facilities are better, infrastructure is better. Quite different impact for an earthquake than if you're living in the east on reclaimed, very soft terrain.
Stephen Mansfield, thank you very much for your time and for all the effort you've put into the book.
Geraldine, thanks very much for that.
And Stephen's book is Tokyo, A Biography, The Story of an Indomitable City. It's published by Tuttle Publishing.